A public hearing on two bills, House Bill 2467 and 2481, in order to make it possible for Representative McPherson to testify and then get on with his other business today. So we will open those public hearings. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to our committee.
I am very impressed with the discipline you have established within your committee. I have an early morning meeting that, under pressure from my members, meets at 8:30, and they drift in between 8:30 and 8:40. So I think you've obviously disciplined.
The record will show that we had two members here before the chair this morning.
So, so it is impressive. Any particular order you would prefer to hear on these bills?
Your pleasure.
Okay. Representative Pearson. I take up the House Bill 2467 first. This bill relates to a trend in retirement savings that is referred to generally in the field as automatic enrollment. And the mechanism is that instead of employees having to affirmatively sign up to elect a certain reduction in their pay so that those dollars can go into a retirement savings vehicle like principally a 401k plan, but also a 457 plan, which is a parallel kind of vehicle for public employees, or a 403b annuity. Those would be the principal forms that those take, although there are a couple of other more exotic varieties as well. That money automatically, but under the terms of the employer's plan, is taken out of the employee's pay and put into the retirement account unless the employee says, no, don't do that. And even though the employee could have elected affirmatively to have that salary reduction contribution made into a retirement account for the employee, human nature and inertia being what it is, it has been demonstrated that there is a much higher participation rate if it is an automatic enrollment at a certain percentage of pay than if it is left to the employee to affirmatively choose it. Because employees will just not get around to it, even though they intend to start saving for retirement. You know, the pressure of other things and distractions causes them not to do so. So there is a trend toward automatic enrollment, and that's been picking up momentum in recent years, so that a lot of employers are now using that device. But it has been under a legal cloud for a number of years because of state statutes, which exist in Oregon and in every other state, which require that there cannot be a deduction from an employee's pay without a written authorization from the employee. And it goes back to the days of the company store where there were inappropriate practices by some employers without an employee's authorization or approval to take money out of their pay for various purposes. But it really doesn't have any appropriate connection to this situation of automatic enrollment, because the retirement accounts into which the money is going belong to the employee. The employee is going to get that money. It's just taking the money out of the employee's paycheck and putting it into an account which is fully dedicated to that employee's best interests and ultimately to their retirement, if it's a retirement version of the vehicle. The federal government has been pushing to overcome the potential impact of those state statutes. And I should say it's really only a potential impact, because to my knowledge there has never been a lawsuit by an employee who had an automatic enrollment deduction taken out of their pay and put into their own retirement account challenging that deduction. But there's a legal cloud over it. The federal government has tried to overcome that, first was on a regulatory level. The Department of Labor issued an opinion saying that those state statutes were preempted by prior federal law. And then the Congress enacted a statute this last August, the Pension Protection Act, that had included within it a provision that said that those state statutes don't prevent this from happening. There are some employers who are still concerned that maybe the federal government doesn't have the power to tell the states to do that. So the purpose of House Bill 2467 is to carve out an exception unto Oregon's statute to say that if there is a deduction made for a contribution to an individual account for the employee's benefit under a number of sections that I've referenced there, 125, 401k, 403b, 408, 408a, and 457 of the Internal Revenue Code, that will be an exception to Oregon statute. So it just eliminates the issue. It means that any employer in Oregon who is considering an automatic enrollment system for 401k contributions or 457 contributions can implement it and know that the Oregon statute requiring an employee's authorization for payroll deductions won't prevent them from doing so or create a remedy by the employee against the employer. So those are the guts of the bill. A couple of things I would point out are that among the sections that are included in the bill is Section 125, which is not a retirement savings vehicle. The others are. Those are all retirement accounts. What Section 125 is labeled cafeteria plans, and the way salary reduction contributions are made under a cafeteria plan is for health care expenses that are not otherwise covered by insurance and for dependent care expenses. And employers have the opportunity, and many do, have a Section 125 plan under which their employees can reduce their pay and have it go into an account which will be available to be drawn down during the coming year for health expenses and for dependent care expenses. Now, after the bill was drafted, I realized that there, in that scenario, Section 125, not true of the others, there is it is under a use it or lose it rule, the way most of those plans work, so that whatever you haven't used by year end is forfeited to the employer. And so some might say, well, maybe it's not appropriate to have this automatic deduction system applicable to Section 125 plans. And if that were the view of the committee, that would be fine with me to amend that provision out. I think there's still merit in allowing that to be done on an automatic deduction basis, too, if an employer designed a plan that would make that appropriate. But I think it's not really the key issue. The key issue is the other sections, which are retirement vehicles and which are always fully vested. There's no event in which an employee's salary reduction contribution would ever be forfeited from one of those accounts. The other point that has come up in discussions with staff is that this bill does not address the way that the retirement contributions are invested after they are automatically deducted. Typically, these kinds of vehicles have the employee directing among a menu of investment choices. And when the employee is making the choice, the employee takes the responsibility for what the investment results are. But in an automatic enrollment system, since the employee hasn't affirmatively chosen to have it happen, those contributions then have to be invested under a default rule, that is a rule that applies in the absence of an employee choice. This bill currently doesn't address what happens. Under 401k plans, there's a separate statute now that deals with default investment options, so it would be covered under federal law. But as to the state vehicles, particularly Section 457, those are a state or public employee savings vehicle, and they are not subject to ERISA, the federal statute that regulates retirement plans. So it may be appropriate to have a default investment rule applied for these state plans, and I'm certainly open to that. I don't think it's essential, but because I think that's the sort of thing that could be done by rule, by, for example, the treasurer's office and how they run the main 457 plan that covers public employees in Oregon, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to do that. So I've been rattling along probably at greater length than I should over an area that I know a lot of experience because it's how I made my living over the last several decades, but I realize it's pretty new information to you, so let me pause and see if there are any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative McPherson. Representative Gerard, first.
Oh, thank you. Representative McPherson, it looks like a pretty straightforward bill. There's two points I want to clarify. One's real simple. This isn't a mandate for the employer. It's a may issue, is that?
Absolutely. Chair Witt, Representative Gerard, this is... This doesn't compel an employer to do anything. They could not even have one of these types of plans. It simply creates an exception to this other statute of longstanding in Oregon that would require an affirmative written authorization before money can be taken out of an employee's pay, and that's an important protection for working Oregonians. I mean, if this weren't going into an account that was solely for that employee's benefit, this would not be an appropriate change to make.
Please.
This actually is a different area that I kind of want to go into. I like the bill, but I foresee a problem in that some employers undergoing bankruptcy have a tendency not to make payments to the state for withholding tax, feds for withholding tax. I kind of see this maybe as being an arena that they might withhold payment for a few days, declare bankruptcy, and create a shortfall for the employee.
Okay.
Can you see where that might be a problem, and we might need to throw something like some protection into this bill somewhere for that?
Chair Witt, Representative Gerard, it would be a problem if federal law didn't already address that problem. That was an issue for the private sector employers, since under Oregon law, public jurisdictions can't declare bankruptcy. So it's a problem for private sector employers, and has been a problem in a few instances where an employer, when they're under economic pressure, they will take the money out of the employee's pay, but they'll be slow about paying it over to the trustee of the retirement plan. And because of that problem, the federal government has already cracked down on that issue, and they have a certain period of time within which the contributions have to be paid over to the trustee within a few days, and if not so paid, then it is a prohibited transaction, which has certain adverse consequences to the employer under federal law. So that problem's been identified and addressed at the federal level.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, I have a couple of problems with this. One of the things you said early on was, we did this in the days when employers were not as regulated by the federal government as they were, and we don't have the problems that we had before. My opinion is that we're going back to some of those problems, and it worries me anytime we do anything where you must opt out instead of opt in. And just because the federal government does it, I don't necessarily endorse everything the federal government does. So I have a bit of a problem with this bill, and my tendency is to let the employee have every opportunity to take care of his own money.
Chair Witt, Representative Riley, that would be an appropriate concern if the employee didn't have the protection here that the employee is given written notice of the contribution before the deduction is made, and the instruction about how to give information about how to give an instruction. So in other words, the employee has to be informed that the deduction is going to be taken and told how to have it not be taken. So the employee is in the driver's seat. This whole approach to automatic enrollment is to encourage our workers to do the right thing. And unfortunately, a lot of people who they understand they should do the right thing, but they don't get around to it. And I certainly respect the idea that employees, workers, should be in control of their own destiny. But I think we should help them get to the right result. And boy, you know, when you look at where a person is economically, if they save just, you know, typically these automatic enrollment levels are like 2% of pay. They're not big. But if you look at 2% of pay, that is the circumstances of a worker who had 2% of pay taken out throughout his working career and how much he has accumulated at retirement as compared to somebody who'd never made that 2% contribution, just always was going to get around to it and never did. Boy, their circumstances are really different when they get to retirement. And if we can help people do the right thing for themselves, I just think we ought to, and remove an obstacle, I just think we ought to do that.
Well,
Mr. Riley,
I tend to agree that we ought to encourage this, but I don't see why we have to take out the written agreement. I mean, it's just as easy to put a piece of paper in front of you with a signature line on it as it is to say, put a piece of paper in front of you that says, here's what we're doing to you.
Chair Witt, Representative Riley. Unfortunately, the actual results, as proven in a lot of cases, is that employers who go to an automatic enrollment system, the participation significantly increases. And it's just because for that employee to look at the piece of paper and decide, oh, yeah, I really do want to have that 2% taken out, whatever the percentage is, just, you know, the actual results demonstrate that people are much, if they're channeled in one direction to do the right thing, they'll continue to do the right thing. They won't sign the piece of paper that says don't do it, but they just won't get over that hurdle of putting their signature down on the election form. I mean, there is a strong trend across the country to do this, and it's because of the growing awareness that with the decline of the traditional pension system, where you had a formula pension that was available at retirement age and that people were guaranteed an income for the rest of their lives, a lot of our workers do not have that kind of financial security anymore. They're depending on these kinds of vehicles, because for so many employers now, when they when you ask what their retirement plan is, we'll say, well, we've got a retirement plan. It's a 401k plan. Well, so for many workers, the sole retirement that they're going to build up is from these contributions with hopefully some matching contribution from the employer. And oftentimes the level of automatic enrollment contribution is set so that it goes up to either the maximum level the employer matches or some medium point up to where the employer matches. So I can certainly hear the sort of philosophical argument that people ought to be in control of their own destiny, and if they can't make the right decisions themselves, then it's not our concern.
I didn't say it's not our concern. I said it can be guided.
Okay. Well, Representative Riley, Chair Witt, it's a bit of a philosophical divergence, but I'm very quite comfortable for my own part in helping people do what's right for themselves.
Thank you,
Representative Polby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, this is an interesting bill, and aside from this philosophical debate, I appreciate your point of view on this. I tend to agree with you about employees really making that choice to get into a plan, and I'm not cold to this idea at all, to tell you the truth, but I do have a couple of concerns in it, and one of them you already alluded to, and that is the Section 125 piece. I really have some misgivings about that particular part, simply because, given the studies and the statistics that show that people will be in the plan because they're automatically enrolled, more than not, that they may not really be aware that they're subject to losing that money in the future, perhaps. So that piece I really am objectionable to. And the other piece that you may have already addressed is the default plan as such. And so I guess my concern with that is particularly if somebody's automatically enrolled in a default plan, I would want to make sure, and perhaps you can enlighten me on that, but I would want to make sure that they would have a choice at any future, at any time, you know, in the future for the first time, that they could enroll in a different plan that was available. And I'm not sure that's always the case in some of these plans. Once you're enrolled in a particular plan, you have to wait for an anniversary date or something else to get into a different option, I suppose. So I would want to make sure that other option was available to that employee anytime they chose to enroll. And I don't know if that flies in the face of federal issues or not.
Chair Witt, Representative Holdy, there's no requirement under federal law for the, and that would be applicable to the non-public plans, non-governmental plans, so it would be 401k and most 403bs and the 408 plans. There's no requirement that there be a menu of choices. It was legally permissible for an employer to have simply one investment program. But it is almost universal for employers to have a menu of choices because that's the way the marketplace has evolved. And they're typically mutual funds or other pooled investment vehicles where there's a diversification of risk. One of the trends also within the field is that it used to be that the default option was a very low risk option. It was a money market fund or a stable value fund, which is a fixed income, low rate of return. And just as there have been studies that have looked at the effect of automatic enrollment on encouraging retirement savings, there have also been studies on the relative results for employees of being in one of those low return options that is no risk of downside. But the risk is that it's not going to grow as fast as if you're in something that's got some exposure to the markets, the stock market, for example. So that now the predominant default rule is a balanced fund, and in fact the Department of Labor on the federal level has adopted new rules that in effect channel or require employers to have their default option be a balanced fund that has some downside risk, but the upside opportunity of growth over time. So that's something that is already addressed in the federal level for most of the vehicles that are covered under this bill. It's for the 457 plans; those are governmental employees, and so they're not subject to the federal ERISA statute. So we could either try to fill that gap in by statute, or it could be done by the Treasurer's Office, for instance, which runs the largest 457 plan in the state, which is the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. So it could be done either way, and either way it would be appropriate to have a default option that has some exposure to the markets that can fluctuate because, yeah, you may lose some money, but I'll tell you, over the long pull, you're going to do a lot better with your money taking some fluctuation up and down than you are if you stay in at some low ball rate of return.
Representative Dolan.
Yes, Representative McPherson, I'm enamored with the idea, but I do have some concerns about our hapless employee. And I'm going to set a scenario that is ridiculous, but it's to make a point. If our employer hires a person at minimum wage and then deducts 2% from their salary, can he say then that we don't offer pay, but we do have benefits? We have a retirement plan, when in fact he doesn't have a retirement plan. The employee has a retirement plan. And I have heard that advertised that way. And we lend credence to that then when we say our employee has to opt out. If our employee is, and I think you've described a scenario that exists, they don't get around to it. But there is some, I see this, there has to be an explanation of the risk involved in having one of the mutual funds. In fact, I think the mutual funds just got caught here 5 or 6 years ago with their hand in a cookie jar, and most of the profits were going to after-hours investors. Does our hapless employee know that? So by the time we get done with this explanation, I want our employee to fully understand what he's getting into. I want him to fully understand the downside risks. I want him to fully understand that this is the open market. And if he understands all of that, then he should understand whether he wants to get in or not, shouldn't he?
Chair Witt, Representative Dahlem, there are disclosures required under federal law about the investment options, so that there will be a disclosure under all those plans that are governed by federal law and could be under state law if we chose to, by rule or statute, to create a parallel system, required disclosures about the investment options. And it is important that employees be informed about that, but I would just throw out one note of caution. For people who are financially unsophisticated, you can paralyze them in uncertainty because they won't, I mean, the markets are a complex and volatile place, and a lot of just regular working Oregonians may be so concerned if you heighten the emphasis on the risk that they don't do something that is going to be in the long term in their best interests, because the markets do fluctuate. Yeah, some of that money that's saved can be lost, but when you're saving it pre-tax, as you are under these vehicles, you know, right to begin with, you're investing, you know, 20, 30, 40% more than you would have been investing if you had paid tax on the money and then turned around and invested it. And so many of our working Oregonians don't actually have the discipline, once they've got that after-tax dollar in their hands, to actually save it as opposed to spend it. So it's important that they have those risks disclosed to them, and that is available to be done under this system of automatic enrollment. We just guide them so that they can opt out, but they're in unless they opt out, rather than out unless they opt in. That's all this bill does. And as I say, it's to conform to a federal law trend, which is already trying to do this, basically to preempt state laws like this. I mean, the reason I'm bringing this bill forward is not because I think it's essential to get Oregonians to this place, but because there may be some employers that at the margin will still be concerned that, well, maybe that federal preemption doesn't really work the way it's set it that will, and so we should, we will, because as long as this Oregon statute exists, we can't see how they match up. We're just trying to put those in line together so we're on in line with where the federal government has always said we should be. And while I don't agree with a lot of aspects of our federal policy, I'd say on this one they're dead right. We should be helping our workers save better.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize if I'm getting in the middle of a conversation that's already been had, but I'm very aware, for example, of the studies that have been done over the last several years on things like opting into email notices from businesses that you do business with over the Internet versus opting out. And, of course, the difference is about 80% of the population, rough numbers, 80 to 90% of the population. If your testimony was, and I suspect it was, that opting out means a lot more people are in the program than opting in, that absolutely makes sense to me. It certainly fits the pattern that I recognize from everywhere else in the world, everything else that happens in the world. I appreciate the questions that I did hear about the technical issues that are involved, and I think we need to work those out if there are any. But I absolutely agree with the idea that unsophisticated people should be opted in first to a program which is beneficial over the long haul, that will work for them over the long haul. And then those who are more sophisticated and will actually make the decision can opt out if they want to. That makes a lot of sense to me, rather than the other way around, for precisely the reasons that you've indicated. People get paralyzed with choices. They don't know what to do, so they do nothing. Well, if they're going to do nothing, I want them to do nothing that actually gets them a retirement account.
Obviously, you're in the choir and I'm in the pulpit, Mr. Barnhart, Chair Witt. I think that's the aim here. The reality is that we have made an unwise policy choice. We have, when the 401k plans became a major component of our retirement savings system in this country, a decision was made to try to turn each individual into their own sort of pension manager. And so we depend on a lot of individual action by workers who are unsophisticated about both about how much to save and then about what to invest it in. And it was, in my view, if I can go off on a tangent a bit, kind of a fundamentally wrong-headed decision. We should have more professional management and design of our retirement systems to assure that people get to a good, an appropriate goal for their financial security, rather than turning them loose to make decisions that are good and often bad, and then an industry out there that of financial services that doesn't necessarily do right by them in all instances. Now that's a topic for another day. It isn't really this bill here doesn't go to it, other than tackling that the one issue of the choice to save.
Yeah, and just one more, and this is really a comment, I think, rather than a question. But I'm on the board of a small nonprofit that employs about 25 people doing treatment for drug and alcohol addiction. The corporation actually will match some portion of a person's fund going into a retirement account. Basically, I think it's a cafeteria plan, but a major component of it is a retirement account. And it is astounding to me how many people in the employees of the business are don't attend to it. Mm-hmm. And the result is they lose not only their own savings, but also the match that the corporation is willing to put in. From a standpoint as a board member of that little business, I would much prefer a plan that opted them in automatically, rather than one that opted them out automatically. It would allow us to do our piece of trying to help people who are relatively poorly paid in our economy at least develop a little bit of a savings account for the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Representative McPherson, thank you so very much for bringing this bill forward. And I just want to make one comment that you perfectly captured the essence of a problem. And I've written down your quote here because it was so perfect that we may indeed paralyze the unsophisticated with uncertainty. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for bringing that forward. Just so that for newcomers, everyone knows where we're at. The committee is open for public testimony on two bills presently, 2467, which we're just wrapping up with Representative McPherson. We will return to that for the public's benefit later, and as well as House Bill 2481. Representative McPherson, would you prefer to have someone from the lottery address that bill, or are you prepared
actually,
to move
Mr. Chair,
forward?
If it's all right, I'll lead off because it was okay. The set of ideas that I brought forward, and then I think you will want to get the perspective from the lottery people. For the record, Greg McPherson, House District 38, Lake Oswego and Lower Southwest Portland, and I think I may have neglected to identify myself, after having admonished many who appear before my committees to do so. House Bill 2481 has two ideas within it that really come from a common source, which is this ongoing tension surrounding our lottery over the commission rates that are paid to the retailers, or referred to in the statute as contractors, who own a business establishment, typically a bar, a tavern, or maybe have broader restaurant services contained within it as well, and that host the terminals for video poker, and for now more recently line games. And there is a percentage of the net amount taken in, that is net of prizes paid out, that is paid to the owner of the establishment. Now the terminals are all owned by the lottery system, so that payment is for, in effect, providing the space and running the establishment that draws the public in, and then also dealing with, you know, some kinds of issues as when people, I think they put, I'm not a lottery player myself, I have to confess, so I think they put chips or something into the machines and then they have to go cash them in at the counter, that kind of thing. There's a bundle of services that the owner of the establishment provides in exchange for a percentage of its net revenue, net only of prizes paid out. And there's been a lot of political pushing and hauling over whether that's the right rate. It is a rate that is set by rule by the Oregon Lottery Commission, that is the board that oversees the lottery system. And there are many critics who say that it's too high, and there are owners of establishments who say no, they're just getting by with what they're taking in. And it's all a debate that's around how much should we be paying for those services. And this idea was brought to me by a constituent here a while back to say, well, why don't you just cut through that debate and use a competitive bidding system for establishing that commission rate, so that because you have multiple providers, and as in any marketplace, when you have multiple providers who are available to provide that service, then find out what the right rate is. The right rate is whatever will be sufficient to compensate them for their services. And so the one of the core ideas in this bill is to study a competitive bidding system. Now, oftentimes you study things because you don't want to do them, but I think that in this case there is a reason to do the study. For one thing, we have a lottery system that, in terms of what it generates for the public purposes for Oregon, has been a tremendous success. I mean, people may be conflicted about whether they think the lottery is a good way to be raising revenue for public purposes, but there's no question but what the Oregon Lottery is a well-run system and that it is generating a lot of revenue for important public purposes. And so we want to step very cautiously in making changes that could adversely affect that system. Also, we have a system under which lottery contracts are renewed for, I believe, a 6-year period, and most of them are renewed through 2010, so that we wouldn't have any impact on the main level of activity until that date in any event. So what this bill does, and this is in response to discussions that I had with the lottery agency, and I got some good input for them as I was developing this idea over the interim, decided better than to just require a transition to a competitive bidding system, to get some really smart economists to come in and model this and see, you know, could this really work and how would it work. So this bill in Section 2 requires a study of competitive bidding to see whether it could work. And while there's some cost associated with that study, I think there's a $40,000 item here. I'm looking at fiscal impact statement that I picked up on the table back there. In any event, it's going to be very small compared to the dollars that are at stake. I mean, in very rough numbers, there's about $1 billion per biennium, I believe, that we get from the lottery for the state. And, you know, the commission percentage that's paid to the contractors is somewhere around between 20% and 30%, depending on what generation of contract it is. So we're talking about big dollars here. And if you could even just marginally improve the return for public purposes, then I think the dollars spent on such a study are small dollars indeed. So that's the core idea that this bill started out with. Section 1 was added into the ideas because of a lawsuit that was decided in December by the Oregon Court of Appeals. It was the Wolf v. Oregon Lottery Commission, and it was a challenge that was brought against the Lottery Commission for the rates that it had set by rule for compensating the lottery contractors, that is, the retailers who host the terminals. And there is a technical reason that probably Dale Penn could explain better than I can about why that lawsuit doesn't affect all of our contracts. I think it's because of the transition to line games and only a certain class of contract is affected. But this this lawsuit challenged whether the lottery commission, the board that oversees the lottery, had properly established those rates. And it focused in on some language that is in the statute now, and you can see it in the printed bill in Section 1. It said the deleted language here, which is that the system for rates is supposed to maximize the net revenue to the state for the public purpose consistent with providing a reasonable rate of return for contractors. It's that phrase, providing a reasonable rate of return for contractors. And what the Court of Appeals held was that the Lottery Commission had not met that burden, that obligation, to study rate of return, to see what kind of rate of return are the contractors getting. And they ruled that the rate system that the Lottery Commission had adopted was invalid because of failure to develop a rate of return methodology and analyze, well, how much of a rate of return are the retail establishments that host these terminals getting. I think we should cut across that because the rate of return doesn't make a difference. I mean, it could probably be perceived from different directions, either negatively or positively. Some people might say, well, the rates are too high; they're an unreasonable rate of return. Other people might say they're too low; they're not a reasonable rate of return. My response would be, it doesn't make a difference. If you've got a marketplace in which there's not just one provider of the service, you've got multiple providers, then the right rate of return or the right amount to pay is whatever will induce the service provider to perform the service. If I make widgets and sell them to the state, whether I make a reasonable rate of return on my widget factory isn't relevant. It's whether I'm delivering good widgets at a price that is more favorable than what the state can buy widgets for down the street. And so I think that we can cure the problem, going forward at least, that was identified in the Wolf case if we simply delete the phrase consistent with providing a reasonable rate of return for contractors, and we say that the system is to maximize the net revenue of the state for the public purposes. And there's a longer cross-reference, which was a recommendation from legislative counsel, but that's not a change. Purposes described in Section 4, Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution. Those are the public purposes for which the lottery is established. This is just clarifying that cross-reference. So there are two ideas that kind of intersect across the same set of issues here. That is that we should solely make our decision on how much we pay the lottery contractors based on whether we're maximizing the return to the state, which will include within it generating a fair return to them so that somebody's willing to perform this important service. And I recognize they are performing an important service to the lottery today. We just want to pay them the right amount for it. And then to study going forward an alternative system for establishing what that maximizing rate of compensation is, that is maximizing to the public purposes, which would consider whether a competitive bidding system would accomplish it. So I'll pause there and see if there are questions.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Representative McPherson, I'm glad that this court case made you think of this, because otherwise I'd think that lawyers must think these things up in their sleep. it's really an intriguing idea, and I'm just kind of on the last bill you had me for a while until you said something about professional managers doing a better job for unsophisticated people. I almost took offense to that, because I've lost more money from professional managers and Jim Cramer than I have managing my own portfolio, so to speak.
Okay.
And I consider myself unsophisticated in that. But I digress.
Just see me afterward, and I'll suggest a new person to work with.
So. But anyway, on this bill, I'm kind of curious if this goes out in this competitive model. I mean, would there be a danger that we might end up with all the video lottery machines in someplace south of Burns because their cost of operating may be the cheapest in the state, and they may be able to outbid everybody in the state? So I'm wondering, the geographic implications of where all these lottery machines may end up. I'm curious if that has entered your thoughts in some of these.
Chair Wett, Representative Holby, when I was originally trying to develop something that would not be a study, but instead would be what the system would look like, and not having any particular background in this, what I envisioned was a set of geographical areas, zones or districts, and the lottery board or commission would do is decide how many machines to have in each one and then put it out for bid within that geographic zone. Now, I was then persuaded by the lottery director and his staff that probably trying to design this as, being a well-intentioned lawmaker but not having any background in this kind of issue was probably not a good idea, and that's why this evolved into a study. But that is exactly the kind of issue the study should address. That is, how do we would have still have maximizing the revenue to the state for public purposes as the goal, as the standard we're trying to meet, and the study then would analyze whether competitive bidding could be useful as a technique to get us there.
Vice Chair Lim.
Yes. Representative McPherson, thank you very much for bringing this bill. Concerning this $40,000 for study, and have you discussed with the lottery director whether they can use it from the lottery money, or where this money coming from, the general funds? What I understand, they cannot spend the money for study from the lottery.
Chair Wett, Representative Lim, yes, my understanding has not come from the general fund, but it is from the lottery system itself. Which I think is the appropriate policy solution here. That is, we've got an enterprise that the state operates, which is the Oregon Lottery, and as I commented earlier, it is a well-run system. I think it's a great credit to the people who serve on the Lottery Commission and the staff of that agency that they've done and the quality of job that they have. And they have, but they can draw against that stream of income that they are charged with generating for public purposes of the state to make sure that they're maximizing the returns that they need to maximize. And my understanding, it would not be a general fund item.
So, Mr. Chair, follow up. Please. Is this your own idea, or have you discussed this issue with the director of the lottery?
Chair Wett, Representative Lim, I am one of those who believes that it's not a good idea to sort of cook up ideas on our own as lawmakers without trying them on the people who are actually dealing with the responsibility. So over a year ago, I brought this idea to the director of the lottery and started engaged in a discussion, and the bill concept has evolved somewhat from as a result of those discussions, and I appreciate the input that I got. It was very helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Jerome.
Thank you, Chairman. The questions I have to do kind of with the way things exist right now, and that is that it's pretty much a free entry into the lottery if for the people that want to be there. And so the model that I would visualize, if you put it up for competitive bids, would have to be almost like a franchise model, like you have a franchise for this area in through here, we're going to put it out for bid. Is that kind of what you're envisioning?
Chair Witt, Representative Girard, I'd say the franchise term, I think, is probably not maybe the most appropriate one to use. There are, I understand, and Director Penn could, I'm sure, give you more information on this. There are other lotteries where the equipment is owned by the contractor, where the state is just taking a percentage of what is being generated from equipment and a system that's run by a contractor. That is not our system here in Oregon. That is, the lottery is owned by the state, and the all that the retail establishments that host the terminals do is provide the place and some limited services connected to them. So I don't think of that as being so much a franchise, although in the classic sense, because in a franchise you are sort of selling the logo and trademark and in a franchise restaurant a range of product and recipes to somebody who then owns the establishment and runs it. This is really the way of thinking of it is, you've got a limited range of services and a sort of a leasehold arrangement to place the terminals, and that's something that could be sort of put in competition with somebody who's down the street who has an establishment where they could have the same number of machines in their establishment. So what I'm envisioning is that you would, within some kind of geographic area, you'd have whatever number of terminals the lottery commission decides is the appropriate number of terminals, and then you would solicit bids from various providers. Now, one of the things that would likely happen, it strikes me, in that system, is that the commission rate wouldn't be uniform. That the commission rate that would be payable to a retailer in Burns might be quite a different rate than is payable in Beaverton. Because of population density and distance people travel and whatever. Whereas now, aside from volume issues, that is a volume of activity, my understanding is the rates are uniform across the state. So there might be more local variation. But I would say about all of this, that's why I was readily talked into the idea of making this a study rather than trying to design something myself that would then take effect.
Follow-up?
Just a follow-up. But you are, the vision that you have is limiting access to the market. And so just in my district, I have Hugo's Pizza has a small number of machines. And I think we are restricted on the number of machines that you can have in each. Yeah. So Hugo's Pizza has one. But if they have to compete with Walmart or Safeway or something like that, it would be real difficult for them to do that. And so it seems by limiting the number of machines, you actually would reduce the amount of money that would be brought into the lottery. So I just see this as being a no-win situation myself, but maybe I'm the only person that does.
Chair Witt, Representative Girard, there's nothing about this bill that would restrict the number of machines, the number of terminals, as compared to what the number of machines or terminals would be otherwise. I mean, whatever, there is now some limit that some number that the lottery commission decides on. They have some criteria for what establishments can host terminals. And I have to confess, I don't even know just how that's done. But what this would say is that whatever that number is, that there would be a competitive system for determining what compensation is paid.
Yes, Vice Chair Lynn.
Current regulations, and that if one installation, if they have more than five, that's considered a casino. In our state, by the constitution, we cannot have casino in our state. So by legally, up to five is not translated, not considered as a casino. So maximum limit we can have is five machines in one place. So in case if it's bet on competition, maybe it could be 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, it could be unconstitutional in our state. Can you comment on that?
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, there is a limit under the Oregon Lottery on the number of terminals that can be in any one establishment, and whether that limit derives from the prohibition on having a casino, I'm not entirely clear, but I know there is a limit. But I think the point would be here is that whatever that limit is not going to be affected by this bill. Okay. That the Lottery Commission is going to decide whatever number of terminals is going to derive the maximum gain to the system, to the lottery program. And we would simply be within whatever number of terminals is appropriate, we would be then using, if the study indicated that it would be, it would improve the performance of the lottery, the lottery could then use a competitive bidding system instead. But only if, you know, this is designed so that this results of the study would be done within a time frame that it could come back to for a report to the next session of the legislature in the 74th Legislative Assembly.
Excuse the question before I ask it, Representative McPherson, but as a potential recipients of the report, do you think that this body ought to have a lottery outlet, video outlet here in the building?
Chair Witt, I think that the lottery terminals should be placed in locations where they will be successful and where the Oregonians who want to recreate in that way would find that convenient. Since I have never played the Oregon Lottery in any way, of any form, I know that I wouldn't be a user, but you'd have to guys check with our colleagues and see how likely they are to play.
Thank you very, very much, Representative McPherson. Are there any further questions or comments? Yes, Representative Foley?
Well, I was just going to ask if this bill was somehow connected to the other one as far as being a potential for retirement savings.
Chair Witt, Representative Holvey. In fact, I would have to say I was surprised to discover that they were even assigned to the same committee, let alone come up for hearing the same day.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, I've been quiet for the last few minutes because I've been reading Section 4 of Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution, the one referred to in the bill. It's a fairly long section, and so it's taken me a while to get through it. And, of course, I recognize that we've passed a number of amendments, even during the time I've been here, to this article. I can't find in it anything that refers, except indirectly, to the Lottery Commission's responsibility toward those who actually administer the games, the retail outlets where the games are located, except a reference that says that the computer terminals or devices will not dispense coins or currency directly to players from such computer terminals or devices. That's the only reference I can see that has anything to do with the administration, except general references that have to do with safety, honesty, integrity of the system, and that kind of thing. If I understand this correctly, and I may not because it's a fairly long section and I may have missed it, the change that is proposed in this bill actually removes any kind of requirement for a return to the any kind of legal requirement for a return to those who who actually administer the games on behalf of the Lottery Commission. Is that your understanding as well?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, that's the case. I believe there's nothing in the constitutional provision that refers to a return to the lottery contractor. It's in the statute that would be proposed in Section 1 of the bill would be proposed to be changed. So that's the statutory reference to a consistent with a reasonable rate of return to the contractor is the phrase that then would creates under our statutes that issue that the Court of Appeals has expressed concern about in the Wolf case.
Thank you. And just to follow up, if I may. So we're making, in this bill, we're really making one substantive change, and that is to remove that requirement. And then the other section is to institute the study.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Representative
McPherson.
I have enjoyed thoroughly your appearance. A little bit of housekeeping here. We are open for hearings on two bills. The chair feels a need to close one. And if I might ask the public's assistance in helping me decide how I'm going to handle this, could I see a show of hands of how many folks are wishing to testify on House Bill 2467? That was the first one on payroll deductions. Show of hands. And a show of hands on the lottery bill that we just heard, 2481. Okay. This is instructive to the chair to open two bills in the future. What I'm going to do is I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on 2481. We are going to remain open for public testimony on House Bill 2467. Everybody with me?
Yeah.
And like to call forward what I suspect is a panel. before our witnesses begin their testimony, another housekeeping item, committee members, we're going to be having an early floor session today. I'm also aware that there are at least a couple of us that have some business that they would like to tend to before we go into floor session. So I am intending to try and wrap up here a little early today, I'm shooting for 9:45, so if I could ask the public's assistance in making that possible, I'd appreciate it. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marianne Guest, representing Oregon School Employees Association. And I appreciate the idea and discussion behind House Bill 2467. I think the lack of retirement savings in our country has been really a problem that needs to be addressed. But I am not in agreement that 2467 is the answer. We'd rather see actually employers pay decent wages so employees could put more money into savings. Clearly, again, there is a need for retirement savings, but we would like to see that at the, at the younger age when in schools that they have, actually that they teach about the importance of compound interest and they teach about the importance of retirement savings. It's really important to instill that in our young people, and I think it would have helped me as an older person now. To say to a busy mom, let's say, that I know best and you should be putting this money aside when this particular mother may have other needs. Her children need braces, or the energy costs have skyrocketed in their house, the gasoline's gone up. To say that I know best, government knows best, or the employer knows best is just arrogant and not true. I believe this is probably, the discussion is good. I believe there are other things we could do, but it's just not the right approach. Thank you.
Good point. Well taken, Marianne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I am not in PERS. The last week has shown me that the experts have convinced me I will be working 10 more years. So I will be here with you. Mary. Because the experts who are investing my retirement are doing such a fine job that, you know, I'm thinking that after 20 years I could work another 10 and maybe get back to where I am today.
Yes.
You know, and the experts, by the way, they told me to sell Columbia Sportswear.
No further commercials today.
Anyway, we share Mary Ann's concerns. We share the concerns that somebody would suggest to our members that they know best. There is a reason why when we put together the deferred maintenance or the deferred compensation plan for public employees, we demanded that it be invested through the Oregon Investment Council, through the State Treasurer's Office, because we do think they do a good job. I want to remind the committee that compound interest is what got us in trouble in PERS. It is a reality that the people that, and in fact, Representative Barnhart, you were talking about the folks who work in alcohol and drug treatment programs. We represent a lot of those folks. They make barely above minimum wage. We also represent people who provide services for the homeless, who are a half a paycheck away from qualifying for the very services that they are providing to the clients. And it is sort of indicative of the arrogance that we see sometimes when people suggest that we're going to just automatically take money out of your paycheck without your authority, not understanding what your financial constraints might be. And oh, by the way, you can sign up not to have it done, but you won't know it's going to get done till it's done. And our members in those jobs at the very lowest end of the economic scale are the folks who are so busy just trying to survive, they don't have time to worry about compound interest or a savings account. They're just trying to get through every day. Mm-hmm. And I think that while this is a good idea, I think if you did a pilot project, if Representative McPherson wants to do this, then we should do a pilot program. We should do it with very high-end wage earners. And you know, somebody who can have money taken out of their check, and it might mean that they don't get to fill up the BMW this weekend. You know, I think that, you know, you want to do this. Do it at the end of the economic scale where you're not talking about a crisis. And see if it works. And see how well the upper end of the economic ladder likes it. Thank you.
Thank you both very, very much. Let's see, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. well, earlier I said I was against this because of the opt-out instead of the opt-in, because I'm one of the things that you said, Mary, was interesting, because one of the reasons we want to do this is for the low-end people. And so I'm very torn on this one. I think that those are the folks who need this the most, but I don't believe we should do it without their signature. My feeling is, and again, just because the federal government says that this is the right thing to do, it doesn't mean that I agree. And the federal government has a tendency to change their mind every so often, and if we just change our law to agree with theirs, then when they change their mind, ours is still sitting the way I think our laws should be written the way we will think they should be, and if we're superseded, so be it. And I believe strongly that we should not be doing any opt-out in this area. So thank you both for your testimony, and you can comment on that if you'd like.
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we don't take dues out of our members' checks without their signature. You know, we don't take political contributions or, you know, contributions to our PAC without their signature. You know, people that we represent have to sign for everything that anybody takes out of their check. This is sort of weird to me.
Representative Gerard.
Oh, thank you, Chair Witt. Actually, I really enjoy sitting on committees, and I enjoy listening, so I take what the chair says, and I take what you, chair. I want you to know, for your retirement, I haven't figured out. See, we could put video poker machines in the Capitol, you and I together, but instead of video poker, we have House Bill numbers, and if you get four of a kind, you get your House Bill. You have everybody playing.
Mr. Chair, would you use that gavel?
Representative Chair, I have no comment. I don't know about my colleague.
I'm ready to go to work with you.
Representative Dolan.
Yes, Mary, to you, because I've met some of the people that you represent. And how many deductions do they have over which they have absolutely no control? The deduction will be made. Could you give us some, for example, state tax, no choice. Federal tax, no choice.
Social Security,
no choice. Are there any others?
Workers' comp.
So, Mary, where I'm going with this, at the end of the day, and some of your employees are at minimum wage or just above, what are they taking home when we're done with just the required deductions now?
Not much. These folks are barely above the poverty level, and in some cases are not. You know, last session, Ralph and I worked all session long to get our group home workers a raise. And they got a 5 cent an hour raise. That's all that was set aside for them. And that's just, you cannot imagine how poor these people are. You just can't even imagine it.
I don't want to pressure Mary, but some of those.
I can get some hard numbers for you, if you would like me to.
I'd also like you to give us some notion of how hard they work. It's difficult work, and that money is hard earned. And before I reach in there and take some of it, I want to talk to them anyway.
Representative Dallum, I will ask some of our folks from Transition Projects if they could come down and spend a day at the Capitol with me. I have to tell you that I met with that local, and at the end of the meeting, I was having trouble keeping my emotions under control because of the work that they do and how selfless they are.
We'll ask them to come to our work.
Representative Barnhart.
We'll have to pay them.
This bill, as I understand it, does not force anybody to contribute to a retirement account. Well, if I understand it correctly, Mr. Chair, this bill would establish a default for an employer who has a retirement account and who and for the employee who chooses not to make a choice or decides or doesn't make a choice, doesn't deal with the issue, doesn't file a choice with the employer. The current default rule is that that person loses out. They don't get the account. They don't get the savings. This proposed bill, as I understand it, establishes the account, establishes the savings. If the employer has a match, presumably the match would be paid, as in the case of the small corporation that I'm on the board of. I have to say I have a problem with the response from the witnesses, and you can please respond to this, because I don't see this as establishing a mandate. All this does is tell us what the default's going to be when people don't choose.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, if I could respond. I think what the bill is doing is it allows the employer to make that choice, right? It's allowing the employer.
Absolutely not.
It does not establish that. What it does is it is in the case in which the employee does not choose whether or not to participate in the employer's plan, it establishes that the default is that the employee will participate, but an employee can opt out, and that's the choice.
I'm not, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I'm not disagreeing with you. What I'm saying is if the employer decides to do this, then they do the automatic deduction. The employee, if they're not too busy, are going to be paying attention and can choose to opt out, correct? But the very problem that Representative McPherson brought to you was the fact that employees are too busy, they're not paying attention, and so we should automatically do it and allow them to opt out. Well, I'd say the same thing works on the other end, that employees may be too busy, not paying attention, and then all of a sudden they're stuck with an automatic deduction. They just weren't paying attention. It comes out of their paycheck, and it causes not only undue financial harm for them and their families, but can also cause incredible problems for the employer with a whole lot of angry workers. So I'm saying that there needs to be pre-made education, not automatic deductions.
And with an eye towards our clock, I'm going to thank both of you ever
thank
so
you,
much for your notes of caution. They are well taken. And Representative Dahlem, I want to thank you for your line of questioning that would suggest the value that you place on the hard work of employees that make this great state work. Thank you for that. Is there anyone else who, from the public, who wishes to testify on House Bill 2467? Not seeing anyone. If I were an auctioneer, I would have had you right there. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2467 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2481. And I'd like to call forward, please. Dale Penn, did you want to testify, sir?
I'd be happy to briefly answer questions if I can.
Okay, thank you.
My name's Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery, and I did have an occasion to speak with Representative McPherson several times about this bill, and I think the committee did identify some of the practical difficulties in actually trying to implement this type of system. And we're certainly open to the idea of doing a study. I did prepare some proposed amendments for your consideration. I've discussed it with Representative McPherson. And I would simply make this comment. We are examining other ways of trying to deal with this contract system. In 2010, there will need to be a new contract, and obviously that's of great concern to many people, and at the legislature it's a big concern. So bidding is one that I have talked to several economists about. It's an idea that has come up before, and when I was doing the amendment for the line games process, people made that suggestion. My comment was, I have to complete this process in 60 days. We are not going to design a bidding system in 60 days. We'll worry about that later. So there are very many complex issues. There are other systems that have bidding, and yet we are a state lottery, and to have a statewide system, that complicates it. But there are ways, at least, to come up with ideas. Our amendments simply expand it beyond bidding and say that if we're going to do a study, let's try to look at any alternative out there. One of the alternatives must be bidding, and do the study. So that's the amendment that we have. I will say that the issue on Section 1 is an important issue, a legal issue, and I think Representative Barnhart has identified the legal issue. But if you do not have that change in the statute, then bidding or some other alternative would also violate the statute. That is why Representative McPherson was bringing this forward. If it truly, bidding is a process that would be helpful, you have to change that statute. So that's, I think, the thinking. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Vice Chair Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if I may. First of all, As you say, the Section 1 change is really a needed change, and whether we do the study or not, that change is one that you would like to have. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Riley, I've discussed it with my commissioners individually. They think it would help clarify this. And certainly the difficulty here, and I will just quote the Court of Appeals at the end of the opinion. They say, as we've defined rate of return and rate making, this may be an impossible task for the commission. However, that's not our concern. That's the concern for the legislature to correct. And so I think that's the real crux of the issue, that there needs to be some kind of change.
And the other part of my question is, do you need Section 2? Do you need a commission in order, do you need us to pass this law in order to study this issue?
Mr. Chair and Representative Riley, no. As I've said, we've already started looking at that. I don't want to undercut Representative McPherson. He's worked very hard on this, and we are open to doing a study at your direction. But we are going to examine the issue regardless if there's a statute or not.
Thank you.
May I follow up?
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
So you're saying you're going to do this anyway?
Representative Witt, excuse me, and Representative Barnhart, yes, I think that's incumbent upon me as director to be able to recommend to the commission a variety of different options. As I said in the past, when I got involved in line games, we had to do something very, very quickly, and this is very complex, and it was not an option.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahl.
Last session, when we came down and visited the lottery, isn't this standard fare for the commission to examine every aspect of the lottery to determine and maximize revenue to the state? I mean, that's standard procedure, as I recall, when we went through the line games.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dallin, yes, and I believe that the issue that comes forward is you do have to have a retailer network. And maximizing revenue, you have to have those locations if you're going to maximize revenue. It all comes together, I think, under this statement, as the bill suggests, that raising revenue for these public purposes is the goal. But you have to have a well-functioning network to make that happen.
Thank you. I might say that with our trip to the lottery, it was rather impressive when this committee went there last session. They spent a lot of time, and the rate of return far exceeded what you predicted 2 years ago. And as a result, we have a little cash on hand now.
Further questions or comments for... I'm sorry, Vice Chair Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me the current system is working well, to my knowledge. And then it may be premature asking that questions, but in case if this goes to the bidding system, we have, to my knowledge, about 2,000 establishments and 10,000 terminals. Then each establishment will have to have a contract by bidding system. It will cost an enormous administrative cost. And I'm just drawing that question to you and for future consideration.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Lim, that is a very complex issue, and that is the main reason that Representative McPherson backed away from trying to put a statute that said we will do bidding and we'll do it in this manner. I don't know that we can come up with a proposal that would make more sense. Certainly the current system has been very successful, and it is producing a lot of dollars, and you don't want to just dismantle it and just by a statement, here's our new system, and expect it to produce $1 billion. That is the fear. And so that is exactly why Representative McPherson changed the focus of this, say, do a study, and then let's look at it, because we don't want to destroy the mechanism that's there. And I will say that our goal was to obtain $120 million last session, 2 years ago. We were able to produce $300 million, and we're able able to produce that $42 million that you and your, in the special session was able to give back out to local school districts last year. And so it has been successful.
Mr. Penn, we're anticipating formal amendments.
Yes, it doesn't, excuse me, Mr. Chair, it doesn't fit, it hasn't gone through legislative council. I did pass it out to your committee assistant, and there's 25 copies of it. It just really broadens it beyond bidding. It's very simple.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to draft, if I might, someone from the audience to run down to Ways and Means in 170 and tell Representative Crummell that he's on deck. If you would, please. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. I'd like to call forward Bill Perry, please.
Thank you very much, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant Association, and I just want to chat about actually both parts of this bill. We have had extensive conversations about both parts of it, I think, as well as the lottery and Representative McPherson. And I guess my professional opinion would be I just think it's a little bit premature. I think it's good to have the conversation, but I think it's a little bit premature to act on either one of these. And the reason is because, as Representative McPherson stated, and actually Director Penn didn't bring it up, is the court case itself only deals with the contract pre-line games. And so it deals with anybody that has not chosen line games. Once you chose line games, you have a new contract. So this court case does not deal with that contract. So there's roughly about 60 retailers that, if this decision goes through the Supreme Court and everything else, have a potential impact. So there isn't really, I would say, a perceived threat in the short term to the system as it relates. And, you know, it's this decision hasn't been finished yet. Obviously, the lower court sided against Wolf, and the appeals court went with Wolf, and I think the Supreme Court is deciding now whether they want to deal with it. And I will say that I think that that court case, as somebody that deals with more agencies than just the lottery, has a bigger decision than just what we're talking about today. So I think it's something that from an appeals court needs to be decided at the Supreme Court. And that is, the lottery set out a definition of reasonable rate of return. They looked at other states, what other states do, what other countries do, a lot of different aspects as it gets into what is a reasonable rate of return for the lottery. The court system, in my opinion, did something that they usually don't do. They just say, tell the agency, did you evaluate what your statutory parameters are? And in this case, I would say they did. Okay, you can like the decision, you can dislike the decision. That is open for debate. But this particular case, they said, well, yeah, you did decide it, but we don't like the way you decided it. We think you should have done it this way. And that is a pretty dramatic change in the way that courts have dealt with administrative law. So, I mean, outside of the lottery issue, I think there's a bigger issue at stake here is the court system going to start deciding whether or not the definitions are good or bad instead of whether or not they met the definitions? So I think there's, as somebody, like I said, that deals with more than a lottery, I think there is an important aspect that I think this case needs to go to the Supreme Court, because I think it's changed the way we perceive administrative rules in this state, and I think we need a decision on that. So, from that standpoint, I'm not necessarily ready to say that from my perspective, we should act on this, because once again, the contract is up in 2010. We'll have another chance to deal with this particular section after the court moves forward with it. The second is the competitive bidding process, and I would say that those of you that have followed the lottery, we used to have a flat rate, then we had a tiered rate as you made more money or sold more tickets, your percentages went down. Now we have a two-tiered system, which seems to be working fine, but trying to explain it to people that aren't familiar with the lottery becomes almost an impossibility. If you're a large volume retailer, you've got a different tiered system. If you're a low volume retailer, you've got a tiered system. So the point being is I do think the lottery evaluates a bunch of different systems every time they go through the process. The competitive bidding process has been a topic, as Director Penn mentioned. There are, to my knowledge, and some of this is off the cuff, but Sweden has had a competitive bidding process. West Virginia has had a competitive bidding process. So, I mean, everybody, including the lottery and us, are doing some evaluations of whether or not that works. So I don't necessarily think Section 2 is needed from that standpoint, because I think it's in the process of being studied, and I think we have two examples out there right now. But I agree with Director Penn. I mean, the system's been morphed as it is. I think there's other options that we should consider. I think all the options need to be considered, and I know that both the lottery and us as retailers will be giving in our opinions as we move forward. But once again, all this decision-making will happen after next session. So I would just say that from our standpoint, as we're evaluating the case and these different things, I don't know if the action needs to be happening today from my standpoint. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I was just going to touch base on Representative Barnhart's statement about the Constitution. Whether you agree or disagree, what happened in the Trade and Economic Development Committee in 91, which when they established this after video lottery, the committee then, and I don't have the Constitution in front of me, I don't know if you still do, in the bottom section where it establishes the commission, it says that under your rules of operation, you will consider four or five things, safety, fairness. So, I mean, the fairness thing is where that committee came up with this aspect of it, because it's fairness in the operations. It's not necessarily public. And like I said, you can agree or disagree, but that's where the committee at the time came up with this scenario. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate that. Representative Dolan.
Yes, Bill, you talked about settling this issue on definition. Is there a court date? Is there a date set with the Supreme Court? We're looking at 2010 for a new contract. Do you have any notion when?
Chair Witt, Representative Dolan, as of right now, I think that obviously I'm not the either plaintiff or defendant in this case. In my understanding, the Attorney General has asked for an extension on whether or not they want to file an appeal. So as of right now, it hasn't even technically been appealed yet. We're an intervener in the case, and so obviously we'll take an active role. But that's what I said. It's hard to tell now. There's no close date for a decision. That's why I don't think there's necessarily an issue of urgency. And now that, you know, much to my dismay, we're going to annual sessions. I mean, obviously, if it does speed up for some reason, you would have an issue potentially to deal with it next session. If not, I just don't think it's going to happen before then, especially if you have to refile it on the new contract. You know, it's going to be 2 years out. But I think after the Supreme Court deals with the last contract they're dealing with in the system today, you'll still have time to do something before there's impact on any current contractual issues, from my opinion.
Thank you very much,
Bill. Just a clarification here. We're already going as fast as we can, so if there's annual sessions, don't expect it to go faster.
Well, I've always said I never like annual sessions, but if I get my summers back, I'm not too bad with it.
Can I pursue that line? Would you think that 2 months out of every 6 years might be enough?
2 months, I'd have to do the math. I wasn't a math major in college, but as long as, like I said, it's less time, I don't care.
Bill, thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. Yep. One final question. Do you by chance anticipate amendments? I know you referenced Section 1.
Well, Chair Witt, I mean, like I said, from my opinion, when you're looking about competitive bidding, it is an issue that's going to be dealt with.
Okay.
And number two, Section 1 is what's in the court system today. And actually, when I look at the other issues, meaning other agencies that could be impacted by this decision, not the lottery decision, but the fact that they're stepping in and doing definitions, I don't necessarily want to fix it so the court case goes away. Mm-hmm. I need a remedy to the court case for other agency issues. And so I'd rather let the court decide whether they agree or disagree that they can alter decisions, because then, I think there's more issues that we need to be dealt with. And so I would say this is an issue we should probably discuss in 2009, depending on what that outcome is. Because, like I said, we've got attorneys all over the map saying is this good, bad, or anything else. I just don't think, number one, the court's been decided or there's been a full vetting on whether or not this is a good, the lottery piece is good being changed or not.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2481 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2551. I'm going to ask Representative Crummell to come forward, and as he is, Ellen, if you'd please summarize the bill for us.
Thank you, Chair Whip members. House Bill 2551 requires the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to offer applicants who seek both a liquor sales license and a lottery game retailer contract the option of a consolidated application.
Good morning, Representative Crummell. Before you begin, and we have additional witnesses, again, I'd like to remind everyone we have an early session today, and we have some committee members who have some business that will precede that. So if we can, if you can help us manage our time accordingly, we'd be very appreciative.
I will attempt to be as brief as I can, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. You've already heard, Mr. Chair, what the bill does, so I'm not going to take the time to continue with that. This bill came out actually in the 05 session originally based on some conversations that I had had with folks in my district as they were trying to become retailers for the lottery as well as obtaining their OLCC license. And on a tour of the OLCC facilities in Portland, I came to realize that, first of all, OLCC was working still with the Dewey Decimal System and had not quite made it into the 21st century. In 05, then, we fixed that by giving by allowing a $3 million IT project for the OLCC. And with that, it should enable the OLCC to develop online applications and that sort of thing. So, and to consolidate some of their functions. This bill would ask that, or would require, as you know, as noted, the OLCC and the lottery to basically work together. Both agencies collect much of the same information. There is a little bit of information that the lottery collects that OLCC doesn't, and there's a little bit of information that the OLCC collects that the lottery doesn't. But basically they get the same information. So what this bill would require is for them to consolidate their application processes, and so that when a person applies to the OLCC, for example, for their liquor license, they at the same time that application could go on to the lottery for an application for a lottery contract. It would streamline the system immensely. It would probably affect, from the 05 information that we got, it would affect about 100 applicants a year. During the 05 session, there was another House bill, 2005, that constructed a streamline applications for three different agencies. And so what we would like to do is now include OLCC and lottery in that same kind of in that same type of a process. In 2005, for this very same bill, it was estimated that in the first year the cost would be about $70,000 and about $35,000 in the second year. I know that there's not, or I haven't seen a fiscal on this yet, and I understand why there's not. But I would anticipate that because of the processes that they have, that the costs would be able to be kept fairly low. In short, Mr. Chair, this is a good government bill. It moves in the same direction that the governor has wanted to move, with streamlining agency workloads for increased efficiencies and reduced overall costs of services to businesses. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very, very much, Representative Crummell. Questions or comments from the committee? I'm not seeing any. I am shocked.
Well, so am I, Mr. Chairman. I think the bill is fairly self-explanatory. It really is, I think, a good bill. I would love to see it move. It passed the House last session and got held up in the Senate. Maybe we can avoid that this year.
Well, let's hope so. Good government is always a good move. Thank you very, very much, Representative Krummel. Appreciate
Thank you,
your appearance here today. If I could please call forward Daniel McNeil.
For the record, my name is Dan McNeil, and I am the Metro Licensing Unit Manager for OLCC. I'll talk quickly and cut it down as briefly as I can. Our agency has not taken a formal position on this bill, so at this point I'm not here for or against. I just wanted to express one quick concern. The representative just talked about the OLCC's IT initiative that we've had this legislative session. We've got money where we've been essentially revamping our licensing and our license renewal system. Our primary goals in that revamp has been making that process an easy process for our license applicants, and we're really talking about 100% of our license applicants. We have over 11,000 applicants that renew their licenses every year. We process about 1,800 applications for either changes of existing businesses or new businesses. So we've got a large applicant pool, and we've been designing a system that would allow them easy access to apply to renew their licenses online and get the information we need. And it's actually a very minimal amount of information we need for our license renewals. We're also asking for budget approval this session to expand our system so that next biennium we can take license applications online and get the information we need from people online. And we're also looking at streamlining our processes. We believe that streamlining is good government as well. The upshot of this is that we have not designed a system for lottery, but have designed a system for OLCC, and rolling the lottery application into our current process, our online renewal application process, or the future online process will mean stopping our project where we are, doing some extensive reevaluation and a lot of reconfiguration of the system that we've been working with. And we're working with a company that has an off-the-shelf software package. The advantage of that is you get a system that's, you know, used by a lot of different people. It's a pretty generic system. What we found with off-the-shelf is that it's also very expensive to reconfigure, and if there are things that we need to do for lottery that aren't already part of the standard functionality, that can be very expensive, and we're talking, you know, several hundred thousand dollars potentially. And that's our concern, is that this could derail our system to provide good service to all our clients for the benefit of 100 clients that we have that overlap with the lottery each year. And with that, I'll end my testimony and certainly welcome to take any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. McNeil? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very, very much. And
I do.
Appreciate your appearance and keeping us on time. Not encouraging anyone, but if there's any further public comments on this bill, not seeing any hands. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2551. Is there any further business to come before our committee? Not seeing anyone. Ellen, if you'd just give us a real brief preview of Friday's agenda.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Witt, members. On Friday, March 9th at 8 a.m. in Hearing Room C, we'll be having our first public hearing on three bills, House Joint Resolution 15 regarding state ambassadors, House Bill 2831, which makes some findings about international outsourcing of jobs, and House Bill 2726, which establishes a policy related to state-funded research.
Thank you very much. And with that, we stand adjourned.